You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
They essentially take responsibility for the supply chain themselves rather than relying on a sort of a market-imposed traceability system, which would be pretty tricky to set up.
Welcome to Mining Stock Education. My name is Brian Lenny. Today with me, I have Alex Larne, who is the principal consultant at CRU, and Martin Turan, CEO of FPX Nickel. Both have been on MSE previously to give their views on the nickel market, and that's exactly what we're going to do today. Guys, it's great to have you on. Alex, let's start with you. Indonesia's dominance of the world nickel market seems to be growing. In a Reuters article I read this week, or last week actually, Vale Indonesia says they're set to construct a new $2 billion HPAL plant. I want to get your view on where production is at in Indonesia and if it is truly seemingly the all-encompassing future of nickel production.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard to see it going significantly in a different direction. If anything, the activities over the last few months where we've seen curtailments and closures in light of sort of the declining nickel price, but almost all of those exclusively outside of Indonesia, mostly affecting class two ferronickel producers around the world, New Caledonia in particular, as a result of very weak class two pricing, thanks to a massive excess of NPI coming out of Indonesia. We do think that sort of that decline in class two output will help to sort of diminish the amount of surplus expected through 2024, and we saw that it had a pretty quick improvement in prices. I think a lot of investors with short positions have drawn those back in, so it's not negatively impacting the price so much. We've bumped from $16,000 a tonnish to more like $18,000 a ton now for nickel. So it's helped to resolve things, but it hasn't changed. If anything, it's only retrenched the geographical reliance on Indonesia, where we're seeing closures outside, but more production occurring within Indonesia. And I think there's a real appetite for projects in other regions, but it's a question of investors putting their money where their mouth is, right? And I think there was a certain, and maybe it's just because, I don't know, the sort of really hasn't hit the nub yet, if you like, of where people are like, no, we absolutely critically have to get material from outside of Indonesia. I think from an IRA perspective, people are saying, well, maybe if we can get the MHP from Indonesia, we'll process it in Korea or in the US or Canada or wherever else, and then it's fine from a foreign entity's concern perspective. And even if these Indonesian operators have significant China shareholding, maybe we can reorient that, or because they're not necessarily government-linked Chinese shareholders, they won't be impacted. So I don't think downstream consumers are quite at the point where they're really panicking about not being able to rely on that kind of material. But I think there's some big binary decisions that can change that, related to changes in incentives with respect to country of origin and with respect to green nickel, as ill-defined as that is.
With the update, I remember when I was looking at the nickel market much closer, and Indonesia was definitely the largest producer in the world. But right now, what percentage of the world's nickel production is coming from Indonesia, / how much of that is consumed outside of China?
I think about 60% of the world's nickel is mined, and because it's still is mined in Indonesia, and I think so processed would be a similar proportion as well. It's more than half the world's output, and the vast majority would be going to China. I suppose a fair chunk of the NPI is now converted into stainless within Indonesia, but all the remaining, or nearly all the remaining NPI, will go to China, a little bit to Korea, a little bit to India. And then most of the intermediates will also end up in China. The HPAL plants that have been ramping up over the last few years are predominantly, they have some sort of Chinese shareholding, not necessarily more than 50%, but a significant majority. So most of that material, if not all of it, I believe, would be going to China. So the material that isn't is stuff like PT Vale Indonesia, where that material will go to, or at least some of it will go to Japan, where it's further processed. At a bit of a guess, I'd imagine of the 60% of the world's nickel that's produced in Indonesia, 80 to 90% probably ends up in China.
So that brings us, there's a number of different topics or places we're going to go with this. But I think one of the first things, and this is for Martin, obviously there's a ton of that production that's going to China. In an article in the last couple of weeks in the Globe and Mail, they talked about nickel dumping. And this is something actually coming from the steel industry myself, overproduction from many of the European states, actually, Romania and Turkey being two of the biggest ones. They used to dump rebar into the Canadian market all the time. Martin, relate to us what you see on the nickel dumping aspect and whether this is happening or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's happening, but what's happening is that the nickel market has been clearly in oversupply in 2023, and it will also likely be so, at least slightly in oversupply in 2024. To Alex's point, much of that oversupply is sort of rattling around in China / Indonesia within that matrix. It's not necessarily, though, available to the rest of the world. But because China is so well supplied with nickel units right now, that inevitably pulls the benchmark price, the LME price, down. And with the occurrence of the steep decline in the LME nickel price, that has an impact on what revenues can be generated by nickel miners outside of China, let's say those in Western Australia, many of whom have recently had to curtail or shut down production. So it's not physical dumping as such, but it's oversupply which has the effect of effectively suppressing the benchmark price, thereby causing shutdown of production in quote-unquote Western countries, as we've seen in Western Australia, and also providing a disincentive for the development of the potential development of the next generation nickel projects. And so there was, with these periods of sustained fairly low nickel prices we've seen here in late 2023 and early 2024, that's certainly starting to wake some of the rest of the world up, including Canada's natural resources minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, who recently was quoted as kind of citing these issues around so-called dumping of Chinese product, and the fact that there may need to be some type of tariff program or system put into place to support nickel production from Western or from free trade allied countries. Whether that occurs or not is obviously remains to be seen, but it's obviously getting the attention of very senior political leaders who understand that a low nickel price has serious geopolitical considerations for the development of the EV industries in Europe and North America, as well as Japan and Korea, all of whom are generally allied from a political standpoint.
All right, so this excess supply that's out there, is that a function of demand destruction, or is that just simply that production is able to be ramped up to the point where it's exceeding demand?
Yeah, I mean, mine, I'm obviously commented as well, but in general, the Indonesian NPI, there's been a lot of ramp up of all sorts of output, but I think it's the NPI that's had the biggest overall impact in the market, is for the most part lower cost than existing class two supply. Not everything, but a lot of it. So they're able to produce profitably, and especially those that are integrated, Tsingshan's integrated into stainless steel production with Indonesia, it can transfer the NPI molten form, so you don't have to cast it and remelt it, which helps to reduce the cost of stainless. And that integration also sort of creates a strategic reason that you want to keep that material online. Essentially, it's sort of been temporarily profitable. And I think perhaps there's a longer term view that this is a lower cost way to produce NPI right now. So having transferred by banning the export of ores and effectively having transferred a vast amount of MPI production out of China and into Indonesia, there hasn't been much of a strong signal to ramp that down, because those projects have still been able to make money on a cash basis for the most part. Yeah.
So the differential in cost, like if we talk about cost curves and the obvious advantage that the Indonesian nickel may have, where is it in the process for, let's say, a North American producer or Russia or wherever? What is the difference in the cost structure? Is this something to do with the processing, or does it come down to purely the carbon associated with it, and how in the West we deal with carbon pricing and carbon penalties higher than, so where's the differential come from?
I think there's ore quality is a function, and cheap reductants. Indonesia produces a lot of coal. It's not too far from, you know, getting metallurgical coal out of West Australia, Northern Australia. Cheap labor. So I think it's kind of relatively well set up from a power cost, reducting cost, labor cost perspective. And then on top of the reasonably high ore quality, then that sets you up with a pretty low cost base for the smelting. And on top of that, really low capital costs. Whereas if you think about ferronickel plants like Koniambo costing billions and billions of dollars, the capital intensity of the Indonesian projects built by Chinese EPCM companies is really, really low.
Yeah, Alex is bang on. I think some of the costs that are not there that are more borne by Western producers are costs relating to, arguably higher burdens in terms of environmental remediation costs, labor costs, as Alex mentioned, being significantly lower in Indonesia. Another aspect of all of this, I think that is not often commented on, is that the Chinese/Indonesian sort of dominance in nickel production that has been growing here over the last decade, certainly from a Chinese standpoint, they enjoy a much lower cost of capital than their Western counterparts. And from the standpoint of wanting to build integrated operations that either provide nickel that feed into the stainless steel business or into their EV battery supply chains, there are larger strategic sort of integration issues at play that allow them to even, not rely necessarily on a nickel mining operation being profitable or a nickel processing operation being profitable unto itself. These are links in a much larger chain. And if the end objective is global domination in stainless steel production or global domination in EV battery and EV production generally, then they frankly won't care very much whether and how much money they make on the nickel bit of it. That's just a small piece of the much larger strategic objectives of the Chinese state.
So as an example of that, on the battery side, the three largest producers of nickel sulfate, GEM, Bio, and CNGR, are also amongst the larger precursor material producer for battery cathodes. So they'll make the pCAM that then gets turned into the CAM and then goes into the battery cell. So they're already integrated that step beyond sort of purely nickel. And someone like Bio is also the world's largest cobalt sulfate producer. So they combine the nickel and cobalt with a little bit of manganese, that makes the pCAM, and then they can take it downstream. So it's all very heavily integrated. And exactly as Martin says, even if they were losing money on a cash basis on the HPAL, which I don't think they are right now in the current market environment, there would be a willingness to keep that turned on because it's important that they need that material for the downstream operations.
Okay. So, clearly there's going to have to be a distinction between the two sets of production. Twiggy, Andrew Forrest, in the famous Australian investor and company maker, he wrote it, or I don't know if he wrote it, but he was quoted in an article talking about this sort of traceability between clean and so-called dirty nickel, and saying that this is the way forward. And you guys have sort of touched on it. So do you guys feel that traceability is sort of the way forward, and that there will be that bifurcation in prices? Is that a realistic way to see things going forward?
I think traceability might be difficult to manage. I mean, I suppose there aren't millions and millions of nickel producers, so there aren't too many things to try and track. But if the ore is coming from one of a number of small-scale Indonesian mines, transferred upwards and then goes to an MHP plant, which goes to a variety of different nickel sulfate refineries, which then, right, like there's a lot of different steps before that ends up in your EV that you need to trace. And the more steps you go, the wider that network gets and the trickier it becomes to track. So I think strict traceability might be difficult on sort of if it's just imposed sort of top down. If an EV manufacturer just says, okay, well, we need to know what's going on. But if the if you're building a new gigafactory or EV line and you're setting up new procurement deals as a major downstream consumer of nickel, EV producer or someone, then if you're making a deal with Huayu or one of the some producer or BHP or whoever it is, right? Then if you're dealing directly with a nickel manufacturer, as increasingly people are, then they can impose the right. It's much simpler, the value chain, because often in those cases, let's say someone like one of the big three manufacturers in the US might say, they might go to an Indonesian HPAL plant or HPAL plant anywhere around the world, say, we'll buy your MHP. And then either they themselves or a trader or someone, they will pay tolling fees to nickel sulfate manufacturer, EGAM guy, CAM guy, and then the cell manufacturer to get that material all the way through. That because they essentially take responsibility for the supply chain themselves rather than relying on a sort of a market imposed traceability system, which would be pretty tricky to set up. That I believe we're already seeing sort of self-selecting the very high carbon content material on the battery side that goes through NPI that's then converted into a matte and then it's converted into nickel sulfate, which as even though HPAL's ramped up pretty quickly in Indonesia, it hasn't quite met the demand that was seen in China. So there's been more, and there's been a lot of excess NPI available for cheap. So people have been very willing to convert that to matte and then to sulfate to use in batteries. But that comes with an extremely high carbon content. It's like as much as 80 tons of carbon per ton of nickel. And as far as I've seen anyway, most Western consumers seem to be self-selecting out of consuming that sort of material. So as much as there's no strict definition for what's green nickel, there's at least one category that seems to be out as far as Western consumers can continue to make do with what is available from other suppliers.
Yeah, we see what Alex is talking about in our own discussions as FPX with OEMs, with battery makers, where if they can reach back to the sort of the source of the nickel and secure that supply, even of a concentrate, then it makes it a lot easier for them to build up what the eventual carbon footprint of that product will be when they share it with their sulfate partner or with their PCAM partner, as the case may be. So absolutely, we see sort of the end users sort of trying to take control of that themselves. I think it's incumbent also on sort of quote unquote Western nickel producers to collaborate to define what might be termed as green nickel. We know that there's kind of some, mechanisms available even on the LME now around sustainable nickel. I think they've established a threshold of 20 tons of CO2. Of carbon emissions for every ton of nickel produced as a bit of a threshold. I would argue the industry among Western producers may be able to drive to a lower number there, maybe something in the range of 10 tons, and work together to establish a name brand, basically a trademarkable green nickel or other similar type of term, with a set of standards, a set of criteria by which something could be turned to be green, for example, around the carbon emissions. But you could also throw in other biodiversity impacts. You could also throw in sort of labor standards, remediation standards for nickel mining sites, et cetera, that could help to then hive off some of that and create a brand around that in the same way that you have a brand around fair trade coffee or organic produce that you might buy at the grocery store. That's down to the industry, I think, to help define that. But I do think that Western governments can help to play a role then, potentially, if that kind of brand is established, in establishing tariffs on products that don't meet those standards.
Yeah, I would completely agree that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the challenges, I guess, is on the consumer side is that potentially unwilling to tie their hands until they're confident, or unless they're confident, that there's sufficient supply of material that would pass those categories. And that's where you need to develop a system that incentivizes the development of new projects that we know will meet those criteria. And there are steps in that direction, I think, through sort of much more generous governmental incentives for mining or EV related projects that have been available in the past in certainly within the US, but I think you would know better than me, either in Canada as well, but where Chinese investment back in sort of 2015-16, bottom of the cycle, Western investors terrified of HPAL projects because they've all been incredibly expensive and not worked as well as people would have hoped. China says, that's fine. We know we're going to need this for our battery industry. We're going to build these plants. We don't care. Like the capital is essentially a write-off, even though they did it for very low capital costs anyway, right? And I think the Western model of looking at NPVs and IRRs and choosing only the projects that provide the very, very, very highest and taking a very slow and conservative approach is what sort of increasingly leaves you in a tricky situation where if the only if the world as a whole is not working that way, then you end up in a situation where you just allow one type of supply to continue to dominate and you don't necessarily incentivize other materials because you haven't materialized the factors, those geopolitical factors, environmental factors, carbon factors that would incentivize other projects. But there are steps in that direction, I think, through sort of government-led schemes that mean that instead of looking for using a 13% discount on your NPV calculation, you can use a lower number because the government's giving you a cheap loan. So the cost of capital is diminished.
Great points. And I think actually FPX is a great example of basically exactly what you're talking about. Sumitomo takes a strategic position this year in FPX. To me, that is exactly what you're talking about. That's that end user that's going into the junior or the junior developer and saying, yeah, we're going to buy clean nickel in FPX. I think anyways, in my knowledge, it's got to be one of the cleanest profiles out there, what they have to offer. Martin, can you take us through, it's not even just Sumitomo, but you have JOGMEC doing the exploration around the world, that agreement, but how the Japanese have stepped in and made the strategic investment in FPX?
So over the last year, we've had sort of three different announcements around sort of increasing Japanese involvement with our company. The first was a joint venture agreement with JOGMEC for global exploration for the particular type of nickel deposit that we're after, not a sulfide, not a laterite, but the Awaroite nickel iron mineral. So JOGMEC's principal interest there was they recognized that Awaroite could be a potentially disruptive new source of nickel supply specifically for the EV battery supply chain. So we're about a year into that. We'll have more news on that to the market soon, but that work is going well. Then in the fall of last year, we signed a supply chain sort of MOU framework agreement with a company called Prime Planet Energy and Solutions. That's Toyota's battery company, joint venture with Panasonic. And we continue to discuss potential commercial opportunities for potential integration or collaboration going forward with that group. And then, as you mentioned, Sumitomo, Japan's largest metal mining and processing company, they have very ambitious targets on nickel production development, effectively wanting to double their production of nickel over the next decade or so. And they have deep experience in Indonesia, but they've been largely sort of pulling away from Indonesia here over the last few years. And I think as they look out at the rest of the world and the kind of the slate of projects out there that could help to increase that supply for them, our FPX's Baptiste project, I think is of interest to them as evidenced by their investment. All of this kind of tied to this theme of a large car producing country, in this case, Japan, but the same is true of Korea. Looking at the existential risk presented by the rise of the Chinese auto industry, China now exports more vehicles per annum than both Japan and Korea. And that does represent an existential threat to the car industries in both of those countries. And I would suggest also to the European and North American car industries in years to come. And really, the success whether Western or Japanese or Korean automakers will be able to succeed in their transition from internal combustion to EVs is going to be largely predicated on their ability to access the critical minerals needed to do so. And so, I think you're just going to continue to see these types of investments by far-seeing strategic investors in Japan, Korea, Europe, and North America into the really, frankly, the small handful of viable projects outside of Indonesia here.
Alex, I forget the exact timing on it, but Samsung made an investment in Canada Nickel, and it's they have their project located in Ontario. And Agnico Eagle oddly enough, took a position in it too. So my question to you is, the deal with Agnico Eagle is it's a pretty good sizable, they took 12% of the company. Do you foresee that nickel becomes sort of like the add-on to gold companies, much like copper sort of has? And copper makes more sense to me because, you know, obviously copper gold porphyries being the largest producer of copper worldwide, and they sort of go hand in hand. But I really found the deal with Agnico Eagle sort of as an oddball. But do you foresee nickel becoming a component of any of these, maybe not necessarily precious metals producers, but an add-on to these seemingly companies, senior mining companies that don't necessarily have a focus on nickel projects?
I do think, you know, we at CLU, we will do a reasonable amount of work, people looking to diversify their portfolio, especially if they're exposed. I mean, a gold company wouldn't be, but if you're a coal manufacturer, for example, right, you're a coal producer, okay, we want to diversify away from that. One of the most obvious counter-cyclical plays is to look at battery raw materials, and lithium and nickel are always at the forefront of those two at the moment. So we're certainly seeing plenty of that sort of activity, where mid-tier and major miners are both looking to invest in either junior developers in joint ventures with the possibility of wrapping up their ownership stake as things progress and so on, in order to provide that sort of diversification, or in some cases an additional source of raw materials if they're not certain that their own mines are going to be sustained. But yeah, I think it's a little bit more common to see that downstream sort of MOUs you mentioned, sort of major potential off-takers like the cell manufacturers or the car companies, to say, we're very interested in what you're selling. In the event you get on stream, we'd be very willing to take your lithium, your nickel, whatever it is.
So now we go into the nickel forecast for the year, everybody's favorite part of the interview. We'll start with Alex. Where do you see the nickel price ending the year?
So, I mean, CLU's, the outlook's improved, certainly, compared to where we were a few months ago. I think those sort of supply curtailments we saw at the start of the year have helped to reduce some of the sort of the negative sentiment and to reduce the potential size of the surplus in 2024. I think we still see the market being in surplus this year, but not nearly so large as we had previously foreseen. And the fact that we've entered the year, you know, we're 3 months in and price has been pretty strong so far, means that our outlook for the year is certainly more robust than it was a few months ago. That said, I think we're still anticipating a lower price in 2024 than it was in 2023. I think we're seeing prices really in the sort of through the 1700s, 17,000 kind of level, maybe end of the year heading down towards 16. So generally our outlook is that we're right now above where we'll be at the end of the year, but not to a huge or catastrophic extent. I think it looks like there's sort of the resilience in the nickel market that we've seen in the last few months that will prevent really nasty price declines that start to push people cash negative.
Yeah, really tough. Obviously, the only thing you can ever know about a price forecast for sure is that it's going to be wrong. I would say, you know, you kind of have to be guided in part, obviously, in these considerations by the cost curve. You know, with nickel at around $7 a pound or so earlier this year, probably at least 40% of current global nickel production at that point was underwater. So that tells you that it's sort of an unsustainable level. I think, you know, that feels like it may have been sort of a bottom. Hard to know how long you kind of stay in that kind of range. And while we've come up off it a little bit, we're still kind of in the doldrums there a little bit. On a longer term basis, I have been of the view that at least on a US dollar per pound basis, you know, the next generation of non-Indonesian projects need to be viable. That is, they need to have a strong sort of rate of return at a nickel price in the range of $8 to $10 a pound, and that to assume a higher nickel price or to need a higher nickel price than that to underpin sort of viable economics for a next generation project, this cycle will pass you know, for that, before that project can really move forward. So that's where we think from an FPX standpoint, we feel very confident in that range of sort of $8 to $10 a pound in terms of where the price is going to sit later this year or next year. I wouldn't have any reason to think that we're going to be significantly above where we're trading today.
Speaking of price, actually, I have one more question, Alex. I remember 4 or 5 years ago watching the iron ore market, and there was this bifurcation in price of this ultra high grade, I think it was like 67.5% iron concentrate that was getting a premium, and it was around a 30% premium. What price differential would you foresee was needed if indeed we kind of go down this path between you know, high grade or clean nickel and the dirtier stuff?
I suppose it's tricky because it isn't a straight line correlation that high prices means low carbon. There's, you know, the HPAL projects in Indonesia are not especially high carbon, certainly not compared to the smelting ones. And there's smelted nickel around the world that will be producing, you know, that will be at a higher carbon content than future Indonesian production. So I think what's difficult is that it doesn't break down as cleanly as that. If you want to draw a line around things from sort of a country or origin perspective, then you can see that differential becoming more clear. If you say we don't want Indonesian Chinese material just because, then there's a much clearer distinction between, okay, we've got these other projects around the world that need more. And I mean, it's difficult to say because exactly as Martin says, I think projects that have been looking to require more than $10 a pound, even when prices have been really positive over the last few years, haven't necessarily made a huge deal of progress. But yeah, there's clearly some appetite for consumers to pay more. But at the same time, some of the closures we saw in West Australia in January showed that people weren't willing to put the money where the mouth was in order to keep those sort of projects online by paying more than the bottom dollar that they can get away with, basically. So I think it's really difficult to say, and it's complicated by the different materials, like right, nickel sulfate versus LME grade nickel versus payabilities on intermediate products, make things really, really hard to see. And yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't have a strong view myself. I think maybe an extra, well, I think if we were to think about a long-term nickel price globally of maybe $9 a pound would, in light of potential for declining ore grades in Indonesia over time, they're mining a lot of material very quickly, and there's a potential that that's going to get more expensive to process as grades decline. Then if $9 a pound puts a project anywhere in the world on, then, or sort of a, you know, the lowest common denominator project on, let's say, to meet long-term demand, then yeah, maybe another dollar a pound, right? 10 means that if we want that project to be in Canada, in Australia, in wherever it is that we're comfortable with, either geopolitically or because it's likely to be more sustainable from an ESG perspective, then yeah, I think you need that extra dollar a pound minimum.
Yeah, I know it's a really tough one. The nickel market is difficult even for people who live and breathe it every day because of the presence of all of these intermediate products, these other refined products that really cloud the picture. I think at the end of the day, you really just have to come back to that benchmark price and have to consistently be kind of conservative in that. And you know, the nickel market has this sort of this natural sort of hedging or breaking mechanism on it, in that if the nickel price ever goes too high, then you see substitution out of 300 series stainless into a low or no nickel containing 200 or 400 series products. And so, you know, the same type of insane volatility that we've seen on the lithium side, we will just never really see on a sustained basis on the nickel side, which helps things, I guess, in terms of putting a reasonable perimeter around what prices could look like in the short, medium, and longer term.
Right. Alex, can you give us an overview of CRU and the services you offer to your clients?
Of course. Thanks, Brian. Well, CRU is a market-leading intelligence events and consulting company with services across sort of the metals, mining, and fertilizers industries. I personally work in the consulting department, where I do a lot of work related to battery materials and especially nickel and lithium We do a lot of work supporting project financing for junior projects, working with existing manufacturers on diversification in their portfolios, and so on and so forth. Over the last sort of 18 months, we've really expanded our battery material coverage. We acquired a small company about a year ago that has PhDs that are focused on sort of techno-commercial and technological roadmaps for new technologies. And we're just in the process of launching our battery cost service, as well as an energy storage technology and cost service as well. So doing a lot of work looking at future power generation, the future of renewables, the future of battery costs, and the future technology. And then, at least from my perspective, I'm way upstream of that, right? Like, I just have to figure out how all those massive evolutions influence things like which nickel mines come on stream.
Excellent. Martin, can you give us an update on FPX? What can we expect for the rest of the year?
Yeah, so we've got a really kind of healthy treasury now following the investment by Sumitomo and the top-up investments by two other strategic investors, including Outokumpu, the world's or Europe's largest stainless steel producer. So around $45 million in the treasury. We're really well funded now out into 2026. So I think in a very enviable position compared to the peer group of nickel project explorers and developers. Our main focus is really on moving Baptiste as quickly along the critical path as we reasonably can. That the next major milestone for us will be the entry into the environmental assessment process in the first quarter of 2025. There are three factors that go into making sure we're prepared for that. One is engineering, making sure we have the right engineering maturity. So we're continuing some trade-off studies there to that end. The second is environmental baseline and cultural baseline data gathering. And we're entering our third year of that. And we'll be prepared with that full suite of data to enter the process formally in the first quarter of next year. And finally is the engagement piece, engagement with local communities, with indigenous communities and rights holders, and really working to put agreements in place with multiple indigenous groups that are going to be impacted by the project, both the mine site itself and by certain aspects of downstream infrastructure, including the road and the power line. And so that kind of the three E's, so to speak, the engineering work, the environmental baseline work, and the engagement work is really at the core of what we're doing this year. And, you know, the measure of success will be full entry into that EA process at or around this time next year. Also mentioned, you know, the ongoing work that we have with JOGMEC on global exploration for new discoveries of this Awarowhite style of nickel. We will have news on that in the market, but that work is going very well. And I can say our partners are very pleased with work as it's advancing, and so are we. So look forward to communicating more to the market in due course on that front.
Excellent. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on MiningStockEducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.